From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The subprime mortgage crisis isn't over yet. On today's Fresh Air, how mortgage lenders and Wall Street created the crisis. We talk with Paul Mollo, executive editor of the National Mortgage News and co-author of the new book, Chain of Blame. And we'll discuss today's front page news about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the backbone of the mortgage industry. A lot of people have lost their homes to the mortgage crisis, and many of them haven't been able to take their pets to their new rentals, either because pets aren't allowed there or because owning a pet just became too expensive. We'll talk with Stephanie Shane of the Humane Society about their efforts to keep animals from being abandoned by owners who have lost their homes to foreclosure. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember when buying a home seemed like a great investment, and when you were confident that the value of your home would keep going up? Well, Wall Street and the mortgage industry were confident of that too, and that confidence led to practices that backfired and helped create the subprime mortgage crisis, a crisis that has damaged the American economy and infected the global economy. My guest, Paul Molo, is the co-author of the new book, Chain of Blame. It explains the role of mortgage lenders and Wall Street in creating the subprime crisis. Molo is the executive editor of National Mortgage News. A little later, we'll talk about the latest developments with the government-chartered mortgage investment companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Paul Molo, welcome to Fresh Air. Although subprime mortgages have kind of killed the economy, initially, the mortgage lenders and the banks who invested in them thought that they'd make money. Now, since subprime mortgages were loans for people who had bad credit or didn't have adequate income to qualify for a regular loan, how did everyone think they'd make money on such risky loans?
Well, Wall Street operated under the premise that the value of houses would keep going up 20% a year in hot markets. They believed that they could package these loans into bonds and charge, you know, 2 points higher than, say, the people who had very good credit, package them into bonds, sell them overseas into domestic investors, and that if something went wrong, they would get bailed out because, lo and behold, within a year or two, that house would have gone up 20-40%.
So the banks and the loan companies thought, well, even if somebody defaults on the loan, then the mortgage company gets the house. The house has risen in value, so they made a profit right there.
Oh, yeah. So it was a big investment in this belief that there was no gravity to housing prices. And Wall Street really didn't care a whole lot, from what we investigated, on the quality of the loans that they were investing in and buying.
So let's start with the subprime loans. What are the other things that made these loans risky?
Well, there were different kinds of subprime. I mean, traditionally, subprime loans were made to people in the 1960s and 70s who had a lot of equity in their houses and need to take equity out for an emergency or a car or something or other. In this new breed, this new strain, shall we say, of subprime, the loans were made to people who didn't have down payments. That was a big one. People who were what we call stated income borrowers, which means you walk into a mortgage company office and you say your income is $100,000, and they believe you.
There's no investigation to see, do you really earn $100,000?
There was very a year. They did credit checks. They did a credit check, and they did something called a FICO score, which a lot of consumers are probably familiar with that phrase. They did a credit check and a computerized score on what their credit was, and as long as that checked out okay. And someone said they made $100,000 a year, they believed them. And again, they believed them because, you know, home prices would keep going up. So that was one of the biggest loans that sunk the economy.
So you're saying they believed them because they felt they had nothing to lose.
They had nothing to lose. I mean, yeah, the Wall Street firm that securitized these bonds and sold them to another investor, most of them didn't really they funded the loans to some degree, but they didn't hold on to them. They just passed it on to another investor.
So let's talk about what it means that these subprime loans were securitized, that they were, you know, bundled and made into bonds that people could invest in. Would you explain what that means, how it's done?
Well, basically, the loan is originated by a non-bank mortgage lender, sometimes a bank.
What's an example of a non-bank mortgage lender?
Well, someone like Ameriquest Mortgage, a big California lender, that originated subprime loans to the general public. They didn't take deposits from the public. They just made loans and resold them. They were what we call a non-bank mortgage company. Then Wall Street would buy those loans and package them into a bond. They would take a lot of loans. It's not just one or two loans. They would take thousands upon thousands of loans, pool them into a big security, and sell that security to another investor. Towards the end of the crisis, Wall Street really couldn't find too many investors because the quality of these bonds and loans became under question. They had to invest in themselves, which is where some of these big losses have come over the last 6 months.
Let me stop you there. So the Wall Street companies took the subprime loans, packaged them into bonds, and sold the bonds to investors. So how does the investor make money on these securitized mortgages?
Well, investors always looking for yield. and they believe that their bond will not go bad. So they're looking for a good investment. And the safest investment out there is U.S. Treasury bonds. And if the Treasury bonds are yielding, say, 4 or 5%, and they can buy a subprime bond that yields 7%, 2% more than the Treasury bond, and they think it's a safe investment, that's what the investor's looking for.
So because the people who funded their homes with subprime mortgages were credit risks, they were charged a higher interest rate.
Right. It's
right,
all
because
about,
they were risky. Yeah. And therefore, right. Once these high-interest subprime loans were packaged into bonds, those bonds were supposed to yield a higher interest rate.
Exactly.
Too.
For the company that was right. investing in them, yes. That was the whole point. It's all about yield.
That all sounds great, unless the people can't pay their loans, which is kind of what happened, right?
That's true, and that's what happened in the end.
Yeah.
Now, some of these loans were current for a year or two, and some were what we call adjustable rate loans. And they had a fixed rate for, say, 2 or 3 years, and the consumer felt okay. But lo and behold, in the beginning of 2007, late 2006, those loans start adjusting upwards. And that's where we saw a lot of the damage, where people couldn't pay those higher rates because the economy began to sour.
Now, a lot of the money that was made in the whole subprime era was made on commissions. Who made the commissions, and where on the chain did they make them?
Well, you know, there were commissions in the entire chain of originations. I mean, the modern era of mortgage lending isn't like the old Bailey Building and Loan days where, you know, Jimmy Stewart made the loan as George Bailey and kept it at his institution and sent out the payment coupon book. Here you have loan brokers on the front end. They get a commission for making the loan. That loan gets sold to another investor. The wholesaler funds the loan from the loan broker. The wholesaler, Countrywide, for example, or AmeriQuest Mortgage, they get the loan from the loan broker. They've paid that broker money, a commission for bringing it in. Then they sell that loan to Wall Street, and they make money off the deal as well. Then Wall Street takes those loans, packages them into bonds, and they sell it to an investor, say a German bank, and they make a commission on that bond sale. So you have commissions, you know, every step of the way, at the broker level, at the wholesaler Countrywide level, and the bond salesman at Merrill Lynch. So you have it all through the chain, commissions all the way around. And then finally, that bond or those mortgages rest with the end investor. And they could choose to keep that bond for the long term or sell it to someone else. If they sell it to someone else, there'll be another commission.
Well, by the time everybody's done making their commission, what's left for the investor or at the end of the chain to make?
Well, that's a good question. usually they try and hang on to these bonds as long as they can, because as long as they're performing and the interest rate or the yield is on them is pretty good, they feel safe with those bonds. But before they even get to that point, there's a lot of commissions in that chain.
Now, you described almost sweatshop conditions in the loan approval sections of the mortgage
companies. In the
Bear Stearns
chapter of the book, yeah.
Yeah, explain what you mean by that.
Well, what we discovered, and I guess it was pretty obvious to us because we've been on the beat for, Matt and I have been on the mortgage beat for a while. Well, you have the A-paper mortgages, the good mortgages that everyone likes to make, and then you have the non-prime sector. You know, from what we discovered, you know, Wall Street stepped in here and really tried to take over this entire business of lending to people with bad credit. And they did this by creating such a system where loans would be originated by loan brokers. They would be funded by wholesale mortgage bankers like Countrywide, AmeriQuest, New Century and others. And then Wall Street would take those loans and they would securitize them into bonds, as we talked about. And they created a system where they didn't really have a whole lot of full-time employees involved in this process, Wall Street, that is. So to look at these mortgages that they were buying, Wall Street used outsourcing firms called the Clayton Group was one, the Bohan Group was another. And they basically set up what we deemed sweatshops. They would put all these workers into a big hotel room with laptops. We called them laptop grunts. And they basically had an edict to approve one loan an hour. It was basically described to us as sort of sweatshop conditions, but some of these people were paid pretty good money, the laptop grunts we describe in the book. They had to basically approve one loan an hour, or they felt they had to approve one loan an hour. And it was all about getting as many loans through the system as possible, because the quicker they got the rubber stamp, the quicker the Wall Street firm Bear, Merrill, Lehman Brothers could securitize these loans into bonds. It was all about creating almost like a factory, so to speak, where the loan moves from origination to underwriting, review, into securitization. So they set up these huge contract underwriting deals with Clayton Group and Bohan, and they shoved a lot of people into a big hotel conference room, and they said, here's the loan packages, look at them real quick and approve them. And there was a lot of pressure to approve these loans. We were told in some cases some of the contract underwriters, the people looking at the loans, would sort of be persuaded to maybe change the rating so the loan can get approved. The idea is not to slow the factory down, get as much through the system as possible.
So it was all about quantity. It was about getting as many loans as possible, as opposed to making sure that the loans were made to people who might be able to pay them back.
It was quantity over quality. And again, the fallback would always be the rationalization for this system is that home prices would keep going up. You don't have to worry so much about it. Just approve the loan. It was a crazy, crazy idea when you think about it. But again, Wall Street didn't. It's funny, though, because Wall Street did not want to own their own mortgage companies at first. They didn't want to have all these employees, you know, because they got to pay them. They're full-timers. They got to pay benefits. They wanted to avoid that model. Then after a while, Wall Street decided to start buying their own subprime companies to lend loans. They wanted to secure the factory flow of product through the system, the flow of loans through the system, so they could have guaranteed flow of product that they could securitize. So after a while, they felt safe owning their own lending companies, and Merrill Lynch bought one of the biggest subprime lenders out there. But again, they didn't want to own retail branches. They didn't want to be in a community, you know, making loans at the street level. All the firms that Wall Street bought to lend loans, to get those loans securitized, they were all what we call wholesalers. They all used loan brokers. They didn't want a whole apparatus of employees that they had to put on their balance sheet, had to pay benefits for. They set out to create a machine that employed as few people as possible, few full-timers as possible. They wanted this perfect system that could shrink and grow, because the mortgage market is very cyclical. It booms and busts. They wanted that kind of system. They didn't want all these employees to worry about. So after a while, they started buying their own subprime lenders. Merrill Lynch, again, bought First Franklin. Bear Stearns owned a couple. Lehman Brothers had their own subprime firms. So that was the idea, to create what they felt was a better mousetrap. And in the end, this mousetrap, you know, didn't work.
You've explained a system in which every step of the way, somebody or some firm is making a pretty large commission. Give us a sense of, like, what was at stake there, the size of the commissions that brokerage houses or individual loan officers would make.
Well, we did a lot of research for the book, and we came away with the biggest commission seems to be on the loan broker level. The money that the loan broker would get from the wholesale lender, the Countrywide, the Argent, the New Century. It's all about points. I mean, the riskier the loan, the more points the broker gets. So the yield on the loans, if they bring in a loan with...
Points are like percentage points.
Yeah. How many percentage points they would get. Brokers seem to make a lot of money, and we came across some examples where, you know, loan brokers... Think during the peak from 2004 to 2006, some loan brokers... wouldn't even bother with deals unless they could make $10,000 in fees and percentage points on that loan. So there was a lot of that. The brokers made a lot on the front end. I mean, some brokers were making $500,000 a year. We heard stories about brokers making $1 million a year. And these are people, some people who didn't have a whole lot of experience in the mortgage industry. And the biggest commissions were on the subprime loans.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Mollo. He's the co-author of the new book, Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Mollo. He's the co-author of the new book, Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. He's the executive editor of the National Mortgage News. Second mortgages played a big role in the whole mortgage meltdown. And a second mortgage is when you basically take out a loan against your own home. Would you explain how that works?
Usually you have a first mortgage, your existing mortgage, usually the larger mortgage. The second mortgage is just an additional borrowing against that house. In this crisis, though, you had, in some cases, you had people taking out both a first and a second when they bought a house. And there's a reason they did that. And the reason is that they wanted to avoid this thing called private mortgage insurance. And the way that translates is if you don't have a big down payment, usually 10 or 20%, I think it's 20%, that you had to go out and get this policy called private mortgage insurance, where you would pay a mortgage insurance company 90 bucks a month, whatever it might be, because you didn't have a big down payment. In this case, Wall Street and many big lenders came across the idea you make the borrower two mortgages when they buy the house. And the second mortgage serves as the down payment. So you might have a 90% first mortgage for the 90% of the value of the house. Then simultaneously, if you have no down payment, you take out a second mortgage for 10%, and that serves as your down payment. And this way, you don't have to pay that nasty old private mortgage insurance policy. You have two mortgages on your house, but you don't have to pay that monthly. And the beauty of it is here is you can deduct the interest for tax purposes on both loans. Private mortgage insurance up until recently was not tax deductible. That's since changed. So it was just a way to get someone in the house by doing this fancy borrowing through a second mortgage.
And getting yourself really deep into debt.
Yeah, and that was the other thing here. I mean, in this crisis, a lot of the trouble that was caused was these no down payment mortgages. In the old days when subprime lending was never really big, by the way, subprime lending didn't explode until Wall Street got their claws, firmly into this business. In the old days, subprime lending, people, bad credit, needed money and they would get it. But it was not a big business. And when those loans were underwritten, the subprime loans in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s, those loans were, they used to carefully scrutinize the borrowers, the lenders did. In this new, easy credit world, their credit was not looked at very carefully.
Now, you say that places like the Money Store and Beneficial Finance had loan officers pounding the pavement in search of credit-impaired customers who needed to borrow against the value of their homes and take out second mortgages. Mm-hmm. How did that work?
Well, back in the old days, they did a lot of advertising back then. People who lived in the New York, New Jersey area would see Phil Rizzuto for the Money Store during the Yankee games and on late night TV on WPIX. As a kid, I used to see those commercials. Phil Rizzuto, this icon of baseball, pitching, do you need money? Do you have a house? We can get you a second mortgage. That's how the business was in the 60s and 70s and even the 80s. Where, these legitimate companies were out there originating second mortgages to people who had a lot of equity. They had a home that was worth, say, $200,000. They'd bought it years earlier, and they only bought it for, say, maybe $100,000. So they had this big cushion, and they needed money, and they couldn't get it from their normal bank or savings loan because their credit was blemished. So they would see these commercials on TV or the radio or in the newspaper, and they would, call up, and they would get a second mortgage. But they would be looked at very carefully in the old days. They were much more careful in the old days, Beneficial and Household, and the Money Store looking at the credit of people, because, we didn't have this whole Wall Street apparatus back in the 60s and 70s. Basically, companies like Beneficial and the Money Store, they would make the second mortgage and they'd hold on to it. And if it went bad, they'd go after the customer. And sometimes they went after them a bit aggressively, but that's how the business was. And the defaults, by the way, back then were not very steep at all, not like today. Default rates could be very, very low, under, 2-3%. Today, Countrywide, right before it got bought by Bank of America, they had a delinquency rate of 33% on their subprime mortgages. I mean, that's just phenomenal, unheard of. That's, insane. That never happened. That would never happen in the old days.
So how and when did Wall Street become involved in packaging these subprime loans, securitizing them, turning them into bonds, and selling them to investors?
Wall Street's been in the securitization business since the 1980s. But basically, you know, Wall Street was in this business of securitizing these good quality mortgages, A paper loans, and they were fine, were for years, still are. Then Wall Street in the 1990s got involved in securitizing subprime loans. And other companies on Wall Street, Prudential Securities for one, found that, again, they could lend money to these non-banks, buy their loans, and securitize them. And the business actually was pretty good in the 1990s. It wasn't a big business at all, but it was a safe business because back then, even the companies operating in the late 1990s were somewhat careful about the loans they were making. They didn't make these crazy low down payment or no down payment loans. No one ever really tried it until probably Prudential was one of the first. But Wall Street just found another thing to securitize. I mean, they love securitizing cash flow, whether it's a credit card or a subprime loan. That's what Wall Street does.
Paul Molo will be back in the second half of the show. Molo is the co-author of the new book, Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Conquistador, a history of Hernan Cortez, King Montezuma, and the Last Stand of the Aztecs by Buddy Levy. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the mortgage crisis with Paul Molo. Many pets are being abandoned by people who have lost their homes to foreclosure. We'll talk with Stephanie Shane of the Humane Society about their efforts to rescue the animals. She's adopted two dogs who were abandoned when their owners were forced out of their homes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about how mortgage lenders and Wall Street created the subprime mortgage crisis that has infected the American economy and the global economy. My guest is Paul Molo, the co-author of the new book Chain of Blame, and executive editor of National Mortgage News. Now, you've been covering the mortgage industry for more than two decades. Mm-hmm. Did you see the mortgage meltdown coming? Could you tell something was going to happen before everybody else knew about it?
I knew something was going to happen. When I realized probably back in 2006, you know, I had seen it coming a couple months before. The craziest loan I ever saw was this thing called a payment option arm. And for the listeners out there, it's basically the mortgage where you say, hey, we're going to give you an adjustable rate mortgage, and each month you got four options. One is to pay off principal and interest, one is to pay off interest, One is sort of to do nothing. The other is called negative amortization, and that means keep your payment really low, and we'll just add on to the debt you owe us. So that's the craziest loan I ever saw in 20 years of covering mortgages.
Why is that so crazy?
Well, people used to, you know, want to own a home and pay it off as quickly as possible, not add on to the debt. And when I saw these payment option arms taken off, it just, to me, it was, you know, what is this? And a lot of lenders were involved in that loan. Countrywide was one of them, Washington Mutual, World Savings, which eventually got bought by Wachovia. I mean, you're selling the American dream without, you know, the consumer really getting involved in any kind of sacrifice here. If they can make the lowest monthly payment month after month, 90% of them probably will. And they keep thinking, well, eventually, they know they have to eventually pay off this new debt that they're piling up at the end. But they take on this mental attitude of, I'll cry tomorrow. I'll worry about it tomorrow. I want to keep my payment low. You know, I got soccer bills from my kids' soccer league. I got the car payment. I want to go on vacation. I want to go to Vegas. You know, the consumer rationalizes not making the normal payment. So they do this negative amortization payment where they're adding on to the debt. When I saw that loan taking off, I thought, this is bad. Plus, I just, you know, being in the business, seeing home prices go up 20% a year, that doesn't last for too long. You know, it lasts in selected markets for a year or two and then cools off. Here, this 20% a year going up each year in hot markets like California, New York, New Jersey, I'd never seen that going like that so consistently without the population booming, and the population in this country wasn't booming. But something was fueling it, and what we discovered was that these payment option arms were helping consumers bid up the price of housing because they could keep that payment real low. And if you have a bunch of people with that ability to keep payments low and get into the housing market, it's, you know, supply and demand. And that's what drove up the prices so quickly in a lot of these markets, these crazy payment option arms, which loan brokers sold to consumers, and Countrywide would buy them, or other companies would buy them from the brokers. So that was the crazy loan. But when I saw this thing coming, I didn't think it was going to be this bad. I didn't really realize until, you know, maybe a year ago it was going to be really ugly, but I didn't think it was going to be quite this bad. I knew it was going to be bad, but this is something else.
This is interesting. You're saying that the price of homes was inflated in part because people could kind of get away with paying their mortgage without paying their mortgage. And just
exactly.
Just by putting it off and putting it off, getting deeper and deeper into debt instead of getting out of debt and paying off their mortgage. And because people were deceived into thinking that they could kind of get an expensive home without having to pay much in the immediate future, they were willing to buy it.
Oh, without a doubt. At least that's something I believed in for a year or two now, that the payment option arm, the, you know, sort of a subprime loan in a way, but not really. That was the loan. What came first, before the chicken or the egg? And, you know, high housing prices, or did this loan come about and cause high housing prices? I think this loan, this payment option arm, came along and helped excel home prices in some markets into the stratosphere. That's just something I believed in doing all the research for the book. It's just that this loan, you know, created a huge demand, a huge ability of people to buy homes that they probably shouldn't have afforded or could never have afforded. It wasn't for this one little option where they didn't have to pay the full mortgage amount and could actually add on to their debt and keep their payment really low. That's what I think really drove home prices into the stratosphere.
If you want to buy a house now, do you need a good credit rating? Is it going to be harder to get like a subprime mortgage now?
Oh, without a doubt. Subprime mortgages are near non-existent. Just to give an example, the peak of the industry was 2005, I believe, something like $800 billion worth of subprime loans were originated in 2005. The next year, about $700 billion. That's a phenomenal amount of money. In the first quarter of 2008, $5 billion in subprime loans were originated. The business has basically been wiped off the face of the earth. There's not much of a subprime business out there. It's all gravitating now towards what we call the FHA program, the Federal Housing Administration. People with bad credit who have trouble getting a down payment are now using these government-insured loans. So people feel that maybe the FHA, the government, could be in to get walloped down the road if these new loans being originated and insured by the government come under pressure. But the subprime industry we've known from 2000 to 2007 is basically just about over. I mean, people with bad credit don't have a place to get loans.
My guest is Paul Molo, co-author of Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Molo, co-author of the new book Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. The mortgage news this morning was pretty grim. A front-page New York Times headline read, "Mortgage Fears Depress Shares at Two Agencies, Signs of Worse to Come." The article is about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two government-chartered agencies which are the backbone of the mortgage industry. There were front page headlines this morning about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's shares losing a lot of money yesterday. So before we talk about what that means and how the story's been updated, could you just tell us what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are two publicly traded companies that have government charters. Their mission in life is to provide liquidity to the mortgage market. And the way they do that is that they buy mortgages from banks, savings and loans, and non-bank mortgage lenders, credit unions. And they buy those loans for cash, or they swap into securities. And that cash gets given to the financial institution, the bank or the SNL. And they take that money and go out and make more loans. That's their mission. That's been their charter for many, many years. And they right now, they are the backbone of the mortgage industry in the wake of the collapse of the subprime industry.
So do Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac basically have a lot of the subprime mortgages that are the problem children? Do they own a lot of those mortgages now?
They don't own a lot of them. There's roughly $1 trillion in outstanding subprime loans in the U.S. Together, Fannie and Freddie own, and my numbers are estimates, somewhere in the neighborhood of $140 billion in bonds that are created from subprime loans, and they have AAA ratings, meaning there's insurance on those bonds. So they feel, even with all these defaults, they're going to get paid off. Probably a lot of what they own is guaranteed. So they own maybe 10 to 15% of the outstandings. It's not a huge number. But there is a concern given all the credit quality concerns about subprime delinquencies.
So what was the problem yesterday behind the plummet in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stock prices?
Well, it wasn't directly related to the subprime crisis per se. An analyst from Lehman Brothers came out and said, if this new accounting change from FASB, that's the accounting body, I won't explain what FASB stands for, but this accounting body has said, we think Fannie and Freddie should hold or post more capital against these securities they've guaranteed that are held by investors, big institutional investors, not held on their balance sheet, that they have their guarantees on these securities, and they probably need to hold more capital against them. That's what FASB said. It's a rule that affects many institutions, not just Fannie and Freddie. And one analyst at Lehman Brothers said, well, if this rule becomes law and Fannie and Freddie have to adhere to this rule, they might have to raise $75 billion in new capital. And when that report came out and hit the stock market yesterday, their shares tanked. So that was the issue.
And what's the update today?
Well, the update today is I interviewed the head of OFAO, the government agency, Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, James Lockhart. I got to talk to him briefly this morning, and he isn't all that concerned. He thinks deep down he thinks Fannie and Freddie will get a waiver on this, And that the securities that they guarantee, it doesn't change the risk of the securities. A lot of the securities that are off their balance sheet that they have the guarantee on are A-paper rated securities. And he also reminded me that Fannie and Freddie already have capital set aside to cover these securities. So he feels that I think he's in touch with FASB, the agency is. And I think this rule will not is not going to apply to Fannie and Freddie in the long run. It's going to apply to other financial institutions because right now, in the wake of the subprime crisis, Fannie and Freddie are the key provider of liquidity to the banks and SNLs that need liquidity and that need someone to buy their loans. And Fannie and Freddie right now are the only game in town.
So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have to function.
Oh, yeah. If something happens to Fannie and Freddie, ballgame is over in the U.S. economy. They are the backbone of the U.S. mortgage market. If something happens to them, they get nicked or go out of business, or if the government, worst comes to worst, the government would nationalize and make them pure federal agencies. But I don't think it's going to get that ugly and go that far. But if something happens to Fannie and Freddie, meaning they cease to function, no one's going to buy houses. The housing market will shut down. The mortgage market will be decimated, and it could usher in the Great Depression that people keep think is just around the corner. But I think the government and everyone in the government, the White House and Congress, realize the stakes on this issue, and I think cooler heads are going to prevail, and that whatever this accounting rule is, Fannie and Freddie won't have to adhere to it.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgages that they buy from banks and non-banks, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac gets those mortgages insured, but they're insured by private companies. And those private companies are in a great deal of trouble too, aren't they?
Well, you have two kinds of insurance here. Fannie and Freddie, when they buy loans that have low down payments, they require mortgage insurance policies to be put on those loans. And there's quite a few of those. There's seven of those companies, one of which is just about to go out of business. So you have the mortgage insurance companies. They have insurance on loans that Fannie and Freddie buy that have low down payments. And then you have the insurance companies, FDIC, AMBIC, and MBIA. They put insurance on the AAA-rated subprime bonds that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have bought in the marketplace. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have these huge balance sheets. They invest in all sorts of mortgages, including their own mortgages, obviously. But they've gone out there, and they've bought AAA-rated subprime bonds. And the ratings on those, the insurance on those AAA bonds come from the three companies I just mentioned, MBIA, FGIC, and AMBAC. And those companies have been under extreme financial pressure during the subprime crisis because they decided to get into the subprime business a couple of years ago and write insurance policies to cover defaulted bonds, thinking, well, these bonds will probably be okay. We don't have to worry about paying a lot of claims on them. But lo and behold, these bonds are not okay, and now they're paying a lot of claims on them, putting them under financial stress.
So that sounds kind of scary, like the backup system is in jeopardy.
It is scary. but again, I think cooler heads are going to prevail on this. And this report that came out yesterday from Lehman Brothers, I think today their stock prices are coming back a bit. So I think there's a belief that, again, things will be worked out. They won't have to post all this and raise all this extra capital, which would be very tough in today's market.
So in other words, things are going to work out with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because there's no choice. They have to work out or else we're all in trouble.
Or else. No, yeah, that's the ugly bottom line. They will make it work out.
Paul Mollo, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Mollo is the co-author of the new book, Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. He's the executive editor of the National Mortgage News. The mortgage crisis has forced many people to give up homes they could no longer afford. Among the many victims of the mortgage crisis are pets who have been left homeless after their owners were forced out by foreclosures. My guest, Stephanie Shane, is the Humane Society of the United States Director of Outreach for Companion Animals. She directs programs that promote adoption and responsible pet keeping and also directs the Pet for Life program that helps to keep pets and their people together. The Humane Society has been posting advice on its website for those caught in the economic downturn who are unable to afford to keep or take care of their pets. Shane recently adopted two dogs who were given up as a result of the financial crisis. Stephanie Shane, welcome to Fresh Air. So what are the signs that some pets are being abandoned as a result of the mortgage crisis?
We started to get concerned at the Humane Society of the United States nationally about 4 or 5 months ago when we heard an increase in foreclosures. And we know from our history working with animal shelters in the country that animals are sometimes abandoned by people who are forced to move, whether it's out of a foreclosed property or simply just out of an apartment. Our effort was trying to prevent this from happening, to get the word out to people that if you are facing a situation that does not allow you to take your animal with you, and if you are not able to find a new home for that animal, to please bring them to an animal shelter rather than leave them in the home that you're leaving. Far too often, animals who are left or abandoned in homes are not discovered until it's too late, until they've died or they're in such a state of distressed health that once they are discovered, they're not able to be saved. So our original concern really was trying to prevent this kind of suffering, to reach out to folks and get them to do the responsible thing for their animal if they weren't able to keep them. What we've seen over the past 5 to 6 months is that the situation is much more dire for animals, and it extends well beyond the foreclosure issue. It really is something that is touching people who are affected by the economic downturn. So people who may not be losing their homes, but whose budgets are suddenly much more tight than they were 6 months, 9 months ago. And the animals, unfortunately, are bearing the brunt of that tightening.
You know, I know some people really believe that it's better for the pet not to take them to a shelter because they might be killed at the shelter if they're not quickly adopted. And some people think that it's just like more liberating for the animal to like leave them in the old home that they're abandoning, you know, that the owner's abandoning, or to take them to a large park and you know, quote, set them free there, mm-hmm. rather than take them to a shelter where they might be put to death. What do you think of that logic?
Well, I think, you know, you can empathize certainly with people who, for whatever reason, aren't able to keep their animal and are afraid to have them euthanized. However, I think it really is a situation of putting themselves in that animal's position. It's tragic anytime an animal is euthanized in a shelter, absolutely. But it is far better, if that animal is going to die, to do so humanely at a shelter than to starve to death in a home where that animal's last days will be absolutely panic-filled. When we find an animal who's been abandoned in a home or an apartment, you can tell the signs of that dwelling show this animal's panic. You can see attempts to escape, whether it's scratching on the door or around windows. Animals have been found with wallboard or carpeting in their stomach, that they're starving and are trying to eat something. So it's a real tragic, scary end for that animal. Likewise, when they're, quote, as you mentioned, set free, that people have this thought that somehow they can sort of revert back to being wild creatures, or that someone might find them and take care of them. And certainly there are good Samaritans out there who would do what they can or would call their local animal control agency to help an animal who was astray in a park or wherever. But it's a very risky situation to put an animal in. It's horrible to see a dog who has been hit by a car or a cat who has been attacked by a wild animal or a dog who's allowed off leash. So it's a very risky thing to let that animal go and hope that things turn out better. And we obviously, if people are concerned about having their animal go to a shelter, they can take steps to try to find a home for that animal themselves. We offer tips on our website, humanesociety.org, for finding a responsible home for your pet. But we absolutely recommend that if you can't do that, the local animal shelter is the best place to take your pet because they will do their best to try to find a new home for that animal. And some people can find themselves, if they have a purebred animal, that they may be able to work with Breed Rescue, which usually has a foster home network. So that would be an option for them as well.
My guest is Stephanie Shane, the Humane Society of the United States Director of Outreach for Companion Animals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. We're talking about how the mortgage crisis has left a lot of pets homeless. My guest, Stephanie Shane, is the Humane Society of the United States Director of Outreach for Companion Animals. Are animal shelters filling up in areas that have been particularly hard hit by the mortgage crisis?
We are hearing from shelters in different parts of the country that they are seeing an increase both in the number of animals coming through their doors, being relinquished by people, as well as the requests from families who are seeking assistance. So someone who is really trying hard to keep that animal with the family, but may need assistance like free pet food or assistance with veterinary care.
How much of a backstory do shelters usually have on the animals that are brought to them? Do shelters know when an animal is being brought there because the owner's home has been foreclosed on?
Oh, that's a great question. And different shelters handle categorizing animals differently, but most shelters are going to find out some basic information about those animals, certainly why the animal is being brought in. So if it's for a foreclosure specifically, they may have more general information that it's for a financial reason, or that the family is simply moving. And your question raises another really good point for people who are giving up their animals, and that is when you take your animal to a shelter, you can provide really valuable information that helps the shelter find that animal the best home. So letting the shelter know what your animal's history has been, what his or her living conditions are like, if they're used to being with cats or children or things like that, it helps the shelter find the best home for that animal. So it's another reason why to bring your animal to a shelter.
Now, you've actually rescued a couple of dogs yourself whose owners gave them up because the owners' homes were foreclosed on. Tell us the story behind the two dogs you recently adopted.
Sure. We adopted Panda about a little over a year ago, and he was brought in. He was one of three dogs. He's a large dog, about 70 pounds, and he was brought in with two other dogs to our local animal shelter here in Washington, D.C., and his family had to move. They were losing their home, had to move into an apartment, and couldn't take these three big dogs with them. We added him to our home, and he has been, you know, just a fantastic dog. We knew the shelter was able to tell us that he had lived with children, and he was a very great, mellow, easygoing dog. But we have small children in our home, so it was helpful to know that he had been around kids and was very comfortable with children. Then about 6 months later, we were looking at the website of our local animal shelter, and my daughter noticed that his sister, who we had seen when we adopted him, had been returned to the shelter. And unbelievably, the family who adopted her found themselves in an unexpected financial crisis and returned her to the shelter because they had to move into a smaller apartment that did not allow a dog of her size. Again, she's a large dog as well. So we added her to our family. So she lost two homes because of housing situations that people couldn't bring the dogs with them.
Was the second dog you adopted more distrustful or more skeptical that you'd be giving him a permanent home because he'd been given up twice?
She was definitely more wary, I think. You know, it took her longer to calm down. It's hard to say why, you know, she was like that, if that was just how she was or if it was because she had been through so many homes. You know, she had been in her home and then at the shelter, and they had placed her in foster care. Then she was adopted, then back at the shelter, then back in foster care. So she had been through a lot in a very short amount of time. You know, only in about 6 months, she had been in a lot of different situations. So she was a little bit more wary and took her longer to relax. But within a couple of months, she was, you know, she knows she owns the place now. And so she's great. And it was great to be able to reunite she and her brother. But certainly, you know, you can put dogs together that don't have histories together, and they can be the best of friends as well.
Do you think your two dogs know that they're siblings?
I think they know that they knew each other. I don't know if they recognize as sort of a family member if they know they're siblings, but I believe they definitely recognized each other. When we first brought her over to our house to meet him, he was thrilled. He was absolutely thrilled to see her. And, you know, they took a quick sniff of each other and went right into running around the yard.
And just one more thing, if you want to help people who are having trouble with their pets or help shelters who are supporting a lot of pets now, what are some of the things you can do?
A couple of things you can do. Number one, contact your local animal shelter. See if they have specific needs that can help them. It's not always a financial donation that they're in need of. There are lots of other ways that you can help your local shelter, whether that's volunteering at the shelter or collecting donations for them in the form of blankets or food. And you know, I think a great thing that happens when you help animals is that it doesn't just help animals. It helps people as well. You know, we talk to people every single day. People are calling our offices at the Humane Society of the United States, and whether they're in a financial crisis, whether they are facing a significant illness, whether they need to move suddenly for whatever reason and can't take their pet with them, you know, the welfare of their individual companion animal is of the utmost importance to them. They may not be able to fulfill that commitment. They may not be able to keep that animal any longer, but it's so important to them that they ensure a safe future for that pet. So absolutely, by helping animals, we help people because we love them. People love them. And, you know, we see this time and again, whether it's a natural disaster that comes up or, again, just a personal crisis, our companion animals are our family. And it's very important to people to make sure that they're provided for.
Stephanie Shane, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Stephanie Shane is the Humane Society of the United States Director of Outreach for Companion Animals. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. From Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Conquistador, A History of Hernan Cortez, King Montezuma, and the Last Stand of the Aztecs by Buddy Levy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
British writer Christopher Isherwood and artist Don Bacardi met on a Santa Monica beach in 1952. Bacardi was a teenager, Isherwood was in his late 40s. It was the beginning of a love affair that lasted until Isherwood's death in 1986. Now their relationship is the subject of the new documentary Chris and Don. We'll talk with Don Bacardi on the next Fresh Air.